closed, however, it means that a safety is covering the middle third of the field, and therefore the front will be an eight-man attack. When a quarterback comes to the line of scrimmage, one of his primary pre-snap reads is to determine where the safeties are. Yours should be too. Because once you and he pin down that placement, the wheel of possible plays in everyone's head can begin to spin. If the read is open, that means the middle seam may be vulnerable, and you can think play-action pass to a tight end who releases straight down the field and sneaks behind a slower linebacker. If the read is closed, start looking for routes that head toward the sideline. Once you make that middle-of-the-field read, you can continue to think like a quarterback by determining whether the defense is playing zone or man-to-man. This one's even less complicated. Before the snap, take a look. If the wideout or tight end comes in motion, is anyone on the defense following him? If the answer is yes, that's man. If it's no, it's zone. How simple is that? When the receiver gets too much credit. On December 13, 2009, Broncos wideout Brandon Marshall set an NFL record by catching 21 passes in a game. I recently rewatched that performance to put that accomplishment in perspective. A couple of things stood out. First, Marshall was targeted a whopping 28 times, and second, his team had just 29 completions total. To say he was the go-to guy is an understatement. Still, I wondered how many of his catches could be credited to Marshall's talent and how many were the result of the play design. My conservative breakdown was that 17 catches could have been made by any professional receiver. This is not a knock on Marshall. I respect his game, his hands, and his skill in getting in and out of his cut smoothly. But although great hands, speed, or leaping ability sometimes can overcome suffocating double teams or an inaccurate quarterback, more often than not, it's the scheme that gets a receiver open and makes the difference. Some version of the following happens all the time in the college game. A receiver runs 10 yards down the field, breaks outside, and makes a catch. There's little man-to-man press coverage in college, so more than likely, he'll have run that route against a soft zone, essentially with no one near him. It might as well be a practice drill. Yet the announcer goes all Dick Vitale, screaming about how talented the receiver is to have gotten so open. Stop. The design of the play got him open. Or think of a well-designed catch this way. At the end of an NBA blowout, when a player snags an uncontested rebound off a missed free throw, it still counts on the stat sheet, even though he didn't have to work nearly as hard for it as he did for a similar board in the second quarter. The stats don't make a distinction, but the spectators know. Likewise, when a receiver gets free access downfield and the quarterback hits him right in the hands, running against air is what we call it, credit the scheme, not the receiver. When they say snow favors the run. Nothing conjures up gridiron nostalgia quite like a frozen field blanketed in white powder. I mean, that's old-time football right there. Unfortunately, it also means that old-time, outdated football cliches can't be far behind. Here's the worst one. If it's snowing, the running game will have to take over. Nope. For a number of reasons, it's actually just the opposite. On a snow-covered field, the passing game has the advantage. As long as pass catchers can handle the slick, hard balls, the slippery field conditions favor the player who knows where he's going, not the one who's reacting and trying to keep up. Snow games are like target practice for the quarterback. Running the ball, in contrast, requires dependable footing first and foremost, not least for the blockers who need a firm base to drive defenders off the ball. Sure, the ball is harder to catch, but it's also harder to keep hold of, especially in tight quarters with everyone tugging at it. In the open field, it's much easier to maintain a handle when you only have to worry about one or two tacklers who are preoccupied with maintaining their footing. It helps if the receiver has perfected the fundamentals of his position and has the key cuts for all his routes locked into his muscle memory so that he can run them in his sleep or on a sheet of ice. That feel for a pass route lessens the chance of a fall. Of course, that's the first thing the Patriots practice every spring, with Belichick or one of his coaches standing right in the middle of the defensive backfield, ready to pounce and loudly correct a player if he cuts off the wrong foot. Belichick, as I mentioned before, dabbles in meteorology, maybe more than any other coach. He knows what the conditions will be wherever the next game is because he wants to make sure to prepare his team properly. He wants them to have the right shoes. He wants them to have a feel for frozen or wet balls, so he introduces greased down or frozen footballs into practice. Sometime when the forecast is rain, he just dunks the ball in a jug of water before every snap. So as with most variables, snow and rain, not to mention sleet and hail, favor the Patriots. When they play battleship football. Do you know the game Battleship? Two people deploy their fleet behind a screen and then call out coordinates for bomb strikes in hopes of hitting the opponent's ships. F5, miss. H5, miss. G3, hit, followed by G4, G5, and G6 until the ship is sunk. That's how some football play callers work all the time. They randomly probe for a play that might work, and when they find one, they repeat it again and again, sometimes disguising it with a different formation or look. Needless to say, smart play callers avoid battleship syndrome. Probing or guessing from play to play doesn't allow a team to gain control of the game. Of course, game plans inevitably require adjustments on Sunday. But those adjustments shouldn't be haphazard attempts to fix what isn't working or find an opponent's weaknesses. Teams need to have backup plans long before kickoff. Successful in-game tweaks are born of a clear understanding of what the other side is doing to keep you from accomplishing your goals. Teams that play the Patriots, for example, know that Brady likes to control the middle of the field with the passing game, and so they crowd that area with defenders and challenge him to throw the ball outside the numbers. But the Patriots don't counter by blindly probing for weak spots with any old outbreaking route. Whatever they do fits into a master plan, say two throws to the sidelines to open the middle of the field, followed by a draw play. That's gamesmanship. Anything else is battleship. When coaches don't get enough credit. In 1966, when Robert Evans was appointed the head of production at Paramount Pictures, most people in the industry shook their heads in disbelief. How could a man with so little experience run a major motion picture studio? At that time, Paramount was a financial mess, headed towards bankruptcy, and the studio's new owner, Charles Bluedorn, believed the only unique approach that countered the conventional wisdom of his competitors would save the day. That made Evans the right man for the job. Paramount had to evolve or it would perish. Evans had a simple but revolutionary idea, to move away from the long-standing tradition of blowing most of the film's budget on A-list actors and instead invest in the talent behind the camera. Evans put his money into directors, screenwriters, and great stories, mostly from books, that could be turned into screenplays so strong they transformed solid but less expensive actors into Oscar winners. During his 8-year stint as studio head, Paramount reemerged as a dominant force in Hollywood behind critically acclaimed hits such as The Godfather, Rosemary's Baby, The Odd Couple, and Love Story. Talent, behind the camera, is just as important in the NFL. Some fans assume the level of coaching on every staff is equal and equally high, essentially canceling the other staff out and leaving the most talented team to win. But the truth is that when the salary cap brought parity to the NFL, it also created an Evans-like shift that put a premium on the talent behind the talent. Just like in Hollywood, it took a while for the paychecks to catch up with the philosophy. I can still remember sitting with Belichick in Cleveland, going over salaries for the upcoming season. When we came to a left tackle, Paul Farron, who was due to make nearly $500,000, Belichick looked at me and said, "I have a hard time with Farron making more than I make." Of course, he was right. Ever since then, I've thought that coaching salaries should at least be in line with the minimum salaries for players. Al Davis loved to hire young offensive coordinators or position coaches he could develop into head coaches, partly because it meant he could keep running the defense, but also because it saved him a lot of money. He never thought twice about paying players, but coaches? That was another matter. Davis would not have approved of the way the Raiders are paying their new head coach, John Gruden. But if $100 million, give or take over 10 years, would give Davis a stroke, it is a clear indication of how much top-level coaching is valued in today's NFL. The problem isn't paying for coaches who could have a huge impact on the success of your team. The problem is paying lots of money whose impact is negligible at best. Bill Walsh told me, and I told you in Chapter 2, that not all coaches have the same potential impact on the game. A great running back coach might be a player favorite, but he's not going to have much effect on wins and losses. Some coaches are there to execute a plan, not create one. But there are 6 staff spots, call them rainmakers, that are in a position to make a significant difference one way or another and should be paid accordingly. Obviously, head coach is one of them. All 3 coordinators, too. And the offense and defensive line coaches. Offensive line coaches are often well paid and deservedly so, because if they can mold one post third round draft choice into a capable NFL starter each year, they have more than earned that salary. The defensive line coach, by contrast, is much like a lion tamer. He might as well be wearing a top hat and coat, because his players come from a pool of what is traditionally the most high-strung and hardest-to-control players. Those giant divas on the D-line need a demanding taskmaster. At least that's been my experience. The best teams I've been with feature that kind of lineman and that kind of coach. Despite their importance, many coaches remain undervalued simply because it's so hard to quantify what they're worth to a team's success. To help remedy that, I've always wondered whether it would be possible to rank coaches and staffs to determine what kind of difference they made on a team. I asked some statistic whizzes at the University of California to help me with this idea, and they suggested that I cluster coaches into groups ranked like golf scores, lowest is best. The system we came up with has the top 4 at each position worth 2.5 points, the next 4 worth 5 points, and so on. Adding the results gives you a staff total that allows head-to-head comparisons. Obviously, this is not a scientific research project. My coach values are, at best, only as accurate as my draft grades, but they still can offer some insight. For instance, let's say the Patriots, with a Hall of Fame head coach and at least 3 potential head coaching candidates on the sideline, have a staff total of 37 points and are playing a staff that graded at 80. Remember, the lower the score, the better. That opponent would need to have a pretty significant talent advantage to cover its coaching deficit. Can a team's roster be talented enough to overcome a 43-point coaching discrepancy? Probably not. That's why coaching matters, and that's why in a few years, a $100 million NFL coach will be considered a bargain. If you're still not convinced, play the Belichick game with me. Think of a team, any team, and ask what its record would be if Belichick coached it. If he left New England tomorrow for Miami, would the Dolphins win the AFC East? It's plausible, right? So don't kid yourself. A top coach is worth as much as a top quarterback. Now, I might be old, but I don't want to be that geezer who rants and raves about how experience matters. It really does, though, especially on the sidelines. In fact, sometimes Super Bowls are determined by it. Walsh once said to me, "I am a much better coach at 52 than I was at 42. I've got a better grasp." And experience helps the most when game preparation meets game management. In Super Bowl 51, Belichick felt confident that his team would score a lot of points against the Falcons. It's not that he didn't respect Atlanta's defense. It's just that after careful review, he saw how his team would be able to move the ball, especially late in the game. He was so convinced that it was going to be a high-scoring game, in fact, that he began to think about ways to extend a lead from, say, a 20-point advantage to 21. Being up 20 is nice, but being up by 21 is way better, especially in a high-flying game, since it means your opponent will have to score 3 touchdowns to beat you. Belichick's solution was to devote 2 5-minute periods in practice before the Super Bowl to work on the Patriots' collection of 2-point conversions. As it turns out, those plays won the Super Bowl. Entering the fourth quarter, the Patriots were down 28-9. After kicking a field goal, they cut the lead to 16 with less than 10 minutes to play. It was still a seemingly impossible deficit for most teams, but not the Patriots. Because they had so much confidence in their 2-point conversions, it felt like only a 2-score game to them. They ended up using all 3 of the 2-point plays Belichick had them practice, the final one to score the touchdown that won the game in overtime. Some might call it luck. The best minds in sports would call it something else. Branch Rickey, the legendary visionary baseball man, had a saying that perfectly defines the often misunderstood value of NFL coaching. Luck, Rickey used to say, is often the residue of design. That's why the best coaches get lucky a lot. It's also why when I watch the best coaches on Sunday, my house is blessedly quiet. Chapter 9. WWBD. What would Belichick do? The only sign we have in the locker room is a quote from The Art of War. Every battle is won before it's fought. Bill Belichick. What would Belichick do is a popular question made famous by Bill Simmons, the sports guy, Boston's most obsessed fan. While observing and commenting on, an okay cheering for, the Patriots dynasty during the last 2 decades, Simmons formulated his WWBD framework and applied it across the sports landscape, especially as a lens through which to examine the NBA. Here's an example. Are you wondering if the Celtics should show loyalty to a high-paid and beloved veteran once his production and skills diminish? Well, ask yourself, what would Belichick do? Answer, send the guy packing like Drew Bledsoe, replacing him with a younger and cheaper, and deflect the public relations fallout with a playoff run. See, what would Belichick do is easy, insightful, and kind of fun too. Bill also happens to be my boss at the website The Ringer, so I hope he wouldn't mind that I borrowed his premise for this chapter. Throughout this audiobook, I've shown you many examples of what Belichick does. Now I want to go deeper and explain how and why he does what he does. I've placed an examination of the following guiding principles into their own chapter because I strongly believe that not only are they the root of Belichick's success, but they can also foster success in other leaders, team builders, decision makers, and innovators. Go to Amazon and search for all the books that talk about Warren Buffett, chairman and CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, who is generally considered the most successful investor of our time. More than 1,000 titles await your purchase. Why? Because everyone wants to read about how he has amassed his unfathomable fortune. To investors, WWBD stands for something a little different. What would Buffett do? To my mind, Belichick is the Buffett of coaching. His rate of winning is far above the competition's. People who want to know what Buffett's secret formula is should want to know about Belichick's too. And no, it's not as simple as draft Tom Brady. Look, I get it. Belichick is not a fan favorite if you live in Buffalo or Pittsburgh or Manhattan or Cleveland or really just about anywhere that isn't flying the Patriots flag. But if you can put aside your rooting interest long enough to see how the guy accomplishes his goals, it may do you some good. You don't have to root for the Patriots to take away some specific action points from the team's 2 decades of accomplishment. A deeper understanding of the WWBD concept can guide us all. The first time I met Belichick was in Mobile, Alabama in 1989, the original home of the Mardi Gras in the States. Look it up. In 1951, Mobile began hosting another week-long celebration of a secular religion, the Senior Bowl. Long before the draft went high-tech and the combine was created and analytics became deciding factors in the NFL draft, the Senior Bowl was the pro game's annual convention as scouts and coaches from every team flocked to it to get their best look at all the top prospects. If you were a college kid and were invited to play in the game, that is what you did. You showed up, no questions asked. The same thing went for anyone in the business of football. For decades, Mobile served as the NFL's de facto annual industry convention, and the old Hilton on Government Avenue was its headquarters. This was long before and even after the Super Bowl became an industry event unto itself. The Super Bowl has never been the nuts and bolts working week that the Senior Bowl was. It was in the Hilton's coffee shop that I had my first encounter with Belichick. The Browns were looking for a coach, and their general manager, Ernie Accorsi, was handling the search. As Accorsi and Belichick chatted, I walked over to their table to say hello. Little did I know then that many of my best days in the game would be by the side of the guy sipping a Coke. Belichick was just 37 at the time, and so that spring the Browns' job went to a veteran coach, Bud Carson, who didn't even last two seasons in Cleveland. The next time around, though, Art Modell hired the right guy, thanks in large part to a fervent endorsement from one lifelong Browns fan, the college basketball coaching icon, Bobby Knight. Within minutes of Belichick getting the Cleveland job and arriving at the team's offices in Berea, Ohio, I had my first assignment and my first glimpse into his unique methodology. With barely a hello, he handed me a three-hole sheet of notebook paper on which he'd outlined in his meticulous handwriting an evaluation he wanted me to perform on every player on the roster. Strong points, weak points, summary, injury history, playing time, special teams role, contract information, production in every phase the player participated in, and general prediction for his role the next year and the year after. No small talk accompanied the delegation of the task, not even a real explanation, to be honest, just here's what I need, and I loved it. Almost immediately, everyone in the organization had a specific task like this and the new focus to move the franchise forward and make the team better. From the beginning, he was a genius at focusing everyone on the primary objective. No less of a control freak than Nick Saban once said of his former boss, he expertly defines what everybody in the organization is supposed to do. That description sounds simple and mundane, but it is not often the way things work when guys become head coaches for the first time. Thus, it was clear from the beginning of Belichick's tenure in Cleveland that he wasn't quite like anyone else who has coached the game. Most first-time head coaches take a few days to acclimate, regroup, and if we're being honest, celebrate after getting their shot. But after his introductory press conference in Cleveland, Belichick took only about 5 minutes to let it soak in. Want to guess what he did next? See, this is how Simmons's WWBD premise works. If you're ever wondering what to do after landing your dream job, ask yourself this question. What would Belichick do? Answer, take charge and get to work. Because this technique provides such good insight into Belichick's distinct way of thinking and problem solving, I've decided to apply the WWBD lens to several different scenarios, starting with the process of book writing. So I now ask myself, WWBD next? My guess is to cut the pleasantries and get to the meat of the chapter. So that's what I'll do. Combating complacency. WWBD? Most people focus on Belichick's 5 Super Bowl rings as his ultimate achievement, but I think that in light of the parity in today's NFL, guiding 7 straight teams to the AFC Championship game will go down besides Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak as one of the unbreakable records in sports. With that much success, whether in football or in the business world, sooner or later, the challenge is how to maintain your drive and intensity. By now, I think my admiration for Bruce Springsteen is abundantly clear. I love the songs, but I admire the singer more because he works so hard at what he does. I've seen him play Born to Run in concert dozens of times. Yet at each concert, it is as if he is playing it for the first time. It's what informs my Born to Run theory, a corollary of the 10,000-hour rule that Malcolm Gladwell popularized. The idea is that to master anything, you need at least 10,000 hours of practice. What Gladwell left out of the theory he documented so well in his book, Outliers, was that once mastery occurs, boredom can set in and undermine that mastery. It's hard to do the same thing day after day. It's human nature to fall prey to the grind. But Springsteen has played Born to Run almost every night, night after night after night since 1975, and it's always with real enthusiasm and passion. He never seems tired of playing the song and therefore never cheats anyone in the audience who might be hearing it live for the first time. In the same way, Belichick never allows himself to get bored, which means he never cuts a corner or underestimates an opponent. He never thinks he knows it all, even when he's played a team a dozen times. If he were a high school teacher, he wouldn't just dust off the lessons from last year to teach the next class. How many of you aced exams in high school after looking over your older siblings' tests because the teacher didn't change the questions from one year to the next? Okay, don't answer, but you get my point. The fact that you've been right for a while doesn't mean you'll always be right. Buffett admits to spending several hours a day just reading, mostly company annual reports. He's pushing 90 years and $90 billion, yet he still strives to be better by trying to learn a bit more each and every day. Reading and research is the best remedy for boredom, but it also guarantees that your thinking will continue to evolve. Self-motivation for a successful coach can be a challenge. We tend to worry that a huge new contract will cause a player to lose his edge. But no one ever considers that with a coach, even though unlike player contracts, theirs are fully guaranteed. Worse, it's those with the most experience who know which corners to cut and how to spend a little less time preparing. But none of that has ever been a problem for Belichick. He still treats every season, every game, heck, every possession, as if it were the only one that matters. Whether the Patriots have just won the Super Bowl or not, the first thing Belichick does is wipe the slate clean. One of his favorite sayings is, "To live in the past is to die in the present." It's why you see no Super Bowl trophies as you walk through the players' entrance and why all those photos from the previous season are removed as soon as the season is over. That clean slate demands a trip back to basic principles and fundamentals after a detailed examination of the current process. Each spring feels almost as if it were Belichick's first day on the job in Cleveland all over again. He explains to coaches and staff that the team cannot be the same as it was before, charging them with figuring out how to improve its every aspect. After the 2015 season, Belichick asked me to break down the successful teams in the NFL. After playing in six Super Bowls, he still wanted to know what other teams did well, how their front offices and coaching staffs operated, and what lessons we could learn from them. My report was both a disappointment and a relief. It turned out that none of the teams I studied had much to tell us that we didn't already know. Dig deeper into college free agents, keep working in the bottom of the roster. We did all that. It's no surprise that a guy who is on an eternal quest to learn more is also a persistent teacher. Whenever there is a holiday, Martin Luther King Day, or Labor Day, or Arbor Day, Belichick uses it as an opportunity to educate his team. He might ask players to explain the difference between Memorial Day and Veterans Day. Do you know? Guys who have been around for a long while know that these questions are coming and tell the newbies to prepare. That is exactly what Belichick wants. It's his way of opening up the lines of communication off the field so that they will remain open on it. He wants to push the connection between curiosity and improvement. Bill Walsh, too, was forever talking about world leaders and bringing in speakers to address the team. I suppose I could have called this chapter, "What Would Bill Do?" to cover all my bases. Walsh forged a deep friendship with Harry Edwards, a sociologist from the University of California, who over the years assisted the coach in many endeavors that made the team better, from interviewing prospects to understanding the challenges facing players from disadvantaged backgrounds. Edwards might have had the title of consultant, but he was more than that. He was the team builder, a culture builder, a unifier. What impressed me the most about Belichick and Walsh is their self-awareness. With the same kind of success in the NFL, many lesser men have become closed-minded, authoritarian, and lazy. Instead of hiding or denying their shortcomings, the Bills embraced them and tried to correct them. In Walsh's case, he saw the locker room changing and understood that he didn't have all the tools needed to relate to younger players. Edwards helped Walsh understand where modern players were coming from and how they were likely to react and behave because of their background. Walsh actually changed the way he addressed the team and the language he used to present his schemes on the basis of what he learned from Edwards. He could have just said, "I'm the boss. Look at these Super Bowl rings. They'll have to learn to relate to me." But he knew that if his organization was to avoid complacency and continue to thrive, everyone needed to learn, develop, and grow, including the head coach. Making difficult decisions, WWBD. When it comes to the art of making tough choices, something every great leader must master, I always come back to two anecdotes regarding the office of the president. In a 1954 speech to the Second Assembly of the World Council of Churches, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, quoting J. Roscoe Miller, the president of Northwestern University, said, "I have two kinds of problems, the urgent and the important. The urgent are not important, and the important are never urgent." It is said that he ran the country by organizing his workload with this Eisenhower principle, attacking the most important issues, not what the press thought needed his attention at that moment. I also love the story of Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy bringing a significant problem into the Oval Office and his brother, the president, asking why everyone walked in only with the hard stuff, to which Bobby replied that it was because they could handle the easy stuff themselves. Now, obviously, running a team is nothing like running a country, but still, each day a head coach has to make tough, hard choices and has to do it under extremely tight deadlines and incredible pressure and sometimes with the whole world watching. Just as Bobby Kennedy pointed out, the art of decision-making begins with knowing what to concern yourself with. George Allen, the former Rams and Redskins coach, was legendary for his obsessive and sometimes destructive attention to what the Kennedys would have called the easy stuff. As the story goes, Allen wanted to save time during lunch by making the players' cafeteria more efficient. So he devised a method that split the soup line into one for the players who wanted crackers and one for those who didn't. Yes, crackers? Urgent? Well, to the hungry guys at the end of the line, maybe. But important? Come on. I mean, it didn't help the team win more football games, although it may well have made it heavy favorites in the Super Bowl. In all seriousness, though, one of the consistent themes throughout Belichick's illustrious career and one of the things that differentiate him from nearly all his peers is his grasp of the art of tough decision-making. It started in Cleveland when Belichick made the wildly unpopular but absolutely correct decision to bench a hometown hero, quarterback Bronny Kosar. Similarly, in 2002 in New England, Belichick's decision to trade another very popular loyal player, Drew Bledsoe, to a divisional rival was met with serious blowback. Why give Bledsoe the chance to come back and haunt you? Al Davis never would have entertained such a move, and it's an incessant fear or superstition among most fans, too. His steadfast mandate was that the Raiders not only would never trade a player, no matter his talent level, to any team in their division, they would never trade him to any team on their next season's schedule. He just wouldn't take the risk. Belichick, though, will do business with any team. He doesn't worry about a traded player taking his revenge because he is confident that he knows the player well enough to neutralize him on the field. Bledsoe started 6 games against the Patriots after the trade and won one of them while throwing 11 interceptions. for the answer to why fans and a lot of football professionals continue to believe it's dumb to trade players to rivals, you can look to the field of behavioral economics, the study of human biases in judgment and decision making. People tend to view the world through the most available information, and in the case of trades between two rivals, the rare examples when they bite the trading team tend to stand out in most people's minds. Though Belichick has made other moves that have looked impetuous or counterproductive to the outside world, I can assure you they were not. He is nothing if not patient, reviewing all the relevant information first. He listens and reads and analyzes before collating it all to determine his own idea of a player's worth. Take Danny Amendola, for instance. When he's healthy, he's a coach's dream. But the wide receiver's injury history makes him a player primed for release every season. Belichick weighs Amendola's leadership values so highly that he always saved a spot on the roster for him, even as assistants argued strongly against it. Belichick's patience, some might call it stubbornness, was rewarded time and again. Amendola was Mr. Clutch in his tenure with the Patriots, making important catches at the most crucial times. Belichick is a master at measuring the risk-reward of any potential transaction. He is also the rare football mind who can lead the players on the field with deep personal connection as a coach, and then, when acting as a general manager, instantly and ruthlessly set aside those feelings to calculate a player's true economic worth. He never lets the emotion of the one role interfere with his calculations in another. A year after the Bledsoe trade, Belichick lost another team leader, Pro Bowl safety Lawyer Malloy, just days before the opening weekend. When Malloy wouldn't agree to a pay cut, Belichick released him, leaving him to sign with the Bills, New England's opening day opponent. After the Bills crushed the Patriots 31-0, longtime ESPN analyst Tom Jackson suggested that the Patriots must hate their coach. Talking directly into the camera, he unloaded on Belichick. You think maybe Jackson overreacted? Belichick was only doing what he had decided was best for the team. He made a call and didn't turn back. Malloy, by the way, never made another Pro Bowl. The Patriots ended the season as Super Bowl champs. Belichick has repeated this formula, unceremoniously cutting ties with beloved vets before their trade value significantly drops, so many times that I've lost track. But the list includes Dion Branch, Mike Vrabel, Richard Seymour, Adam Vinatieri, Vince Wilfork, Logan Mankins, and Jamie Collins, to name a few. In San Francisco, Walsh made decisions the same way, often meeting with the same kind of blowback, which he handled in the same exact manner, by not caring at all. In 1985, for instance, he made the tough and unpopular choice to push wide receiver Freddie Solomon into retirement to make room for Jerry Rice. As much as Walsh loved his players, the team always came first. In Walsh's mind, thinking of his players as human beings first meant only that he was obligated to not let them twist in the wind until he came to a resolution. Walsh called this the three F's of decision-making: firmness, fairness, fast. Having all the necessary information, Walsh said, allows the decision maker to be firm and unmoved by outside influences. That's why guys like Walsh and Belichick weigh each move, understanding every consequence before acting. Knowledge breeds conviction. With all three F's working in unison, the team has the best chance of coming out ahead. In 1986, I added my own F to Walsh's list: fibbing. That year, we took a third-round chance on a talented but raw receiver and return man named John Taylor out of tiny Delaware State. I had seen Taylor in action and loved what I saw, so I pushed hard for him. But in rookie camp and then in the preseason, it was clear that he was not ready to play on Sundays. His talent was NFL-ready, but he couldn't handle the volume of the offense or lock down all the skills needed for the pro game. Walsh saw his talent too, but the roster numbers weren't adding up. John McVay, our general manager, would torture me by whispering that my guy wasn't going to make it. He wasn't being mean. He was just reading the signs. He told me to call other teams to gauge interest in Taylor. I almost got a bite from my friend Gary Horton, a pro scout with Tampa Bay, but in the end, the Bucs passed. Horton's superiors figured that if Walsh was willing to get rid of Taylor, he couldn't be any good. Back then, I was the Turk, the guy who got the names from McVay on cutdown day before fetching doomed players for the meeting they did not want to have. In those days, there was no practice squad, and so a player either made the roster or was out of a job. The only leeway was provided by the injured reserve list, which allowed teams to keep a rehabbing player under contract until he was healthy. Teams often took advantage of that loophole, stashing a player on the IR to keep him around for the next season. Well, I knew Taylor was on the cut list, so I pulled him over in the hallway and advised him to see our head trainer, Lindsey McLean. "You need to tell him you hurt your lower back and that you're in significant pain," I advised. Taylor stared at me a little confused, but then nodded and ran off to the training room. The next thing I saw was McLean running down the hall toward the steps to find McVay to let him know we didn't need to cut Taylor because he wasn't healthy. With Taylor safely stockpiled, we were soon on the road again to scout the next batch of college talent. By the time I got back to the office later in the season, Taylor was the talk of the team. His back had healed, and with just a few more weeks of reps and study, he looked like a completely different player. Walsh was impressed. So was McVay. Taylor went on to catch 393 passes and score 49 touchdowns in the regular season and playoffs, and he won 3 Super Bowls in San Francisco, including one in which he made a last-minute game-winning catch. One way or the other, we got the Taylor decision right, and almost 30 years later, it still feels good. I bet Belichick feels the same way with 99% of the personnel moves he made over the years. Of course, there is at least one with which he may never be at peace, trading Jimmy Garoppolo. As I described earlier in the book, Belichick loves Garoppolo. We drafted him because we were as sure as we could be that he would be the heir apparent to Brady. He already had shown that he could fill those shoes. I don't need to tell you just how big those shoes are whenever he was asked to. During Brady's suspension at the start of the 2016 season, Garoppolo ran the team flawlessly. The kid was the real deal. And the rest of the league knew it. During the 2017 offseason, lots of general managers came calling for the young star in waiting, but Belichick had no intention of giving him up. Brady was 40, for heaven's sake. His days had to be numbered, right? The Patriots looked to lock up Garoppolo with an extension. The only problem was that Brady is a beloved idol who shares an agent, Don Yee, with Garoppolo. That meant Yee held all the cards, and for once, Belichick wouldn't be dealing from strength. To keep Garoppolo, the Patriots probably were going to have to franchise him, pay him like a starting quarterback, which would blow up their salary cap or watch him walk in free agency. There was a fourth option. He could have made an impossibly tough call and cut Brady, risking being run out of New England for the reward of handing the job to Garoppolo. With his track record of calculated, unemotional personnel judgments informed only by the long-term needs of the team, that's what you would expect Belichick to do. If the call was his alone to make anyway, which the word is it was not, because when Belichick passed on those off-season offers, it was clear that he had no intention of losing Garoppolo, and the assumption had to be that he was preparing to franchise him. Otherwise, it meant Belichick was just keeping his fingers crossed in the hope that Brady would opt to retire on his own, and Belichick does not depend on fate. But for whatever reason, Belichick has been as close-lipped about this as he is about everything. The option to tag Garoppolo was dropped. And once it was, Belichick had to act fast before he lost all his leverage and a franchise quarterback with nothing to show for it. So he did the most clear-eyed thing. He traded Garoppolo to the 49ers. It may well be that this trade, a franchise quarterback for a second-round pick, goes down as the worst deal of Belichick's career, and the question will be hard to ignore. In the ultimate WWBD moment, did Belichick, of all people, stray from the tenets of his own philosophy? Developing a winning temperament, WWBD? When Belichick and I were together in Cleveland, Bill Parcells would call me to ask, "How's Doom doing?" At first, I had no earthly idea who Doom was. But after Parcells explained his favorite nickname for Belichick, it made perfect sense. Belichick does not present as the most positive, fun-loving person in the world, and Parcells, who is one of those guys who always knows exactly what buttons to push, enjoyed needling Belichick about his dour reputation. But I can promise you this. Belichick's world is not nearly as dire as he makes it out to be. In fact, away from the media, he is caring and kind, and he actually has a dry, wicked sense of humor. The human side of Belichick is different from the one most people see on Sunday, less intense and incredibly generous. During our time in Cleveland, he gave money he earned from his radio show to the coaching staff as a bonus at the end of the year. When we beat a team in our division, he passed out $100 bills as thank yous. Trust me, if he calls you a friend, he will give you whatever you need. Most people never see that side of him. They see only a gruff, media unfriendly cipher, and that's too bad. Of course, Belichick couldn't care less that only a few select people know his warmer, more upbeat side. In season, Belichick is actually at his most positive at the start of his Wednesday team meeting as he convincingly details the strengths of the next opponent. In this role, he's a spin doctor extraordinaire, making even the lamest quarterbacks seem like Peyton Manning. But in his own way, Belichick means it. He points out worst-case scenarios because that helps him sell the message that each game has to be taken seriously. What makes his players listen is that they know that every complimentary thing he says about the opponent is plausibly true, because it's all backed up by facts. He never cries wolf about a wolf that isn't there. Doom always has the tracks in the snow to prove the wolf exists. I hate to contradict Parcells, but a better description of Belichick's temperament is a term I coined called realistic optimism, which I'll grant you isn't great for nickname purposes. Walsh was the same way. He saw himself as a teacher and therefore believed in being positive with his pupils, building them up rather than breaking them down. Still, he was too well informed not to understand that trouble always lurked. But it's unfair to call either Belichick or Walsh a pessimist, let alone an agent of doom. A pessimist leads an unhappy life, waiting for the next bad thing, never trusting the emotional highs. A realistic optimist may seem a crank to casual observers, but in actuality, he's quite content. That's the case because he sees the world as it is and knows he has the means to conquer whatever challenges await. Realistic optimism is the offspring of confidence and self-assurance, something that both Walsh and Belichick had in abundance. These two coaches achieved spectacularly because, at their core, they knew exactly who they were, and they knew those traits were unique and extremely valuable in a copycat league such as the NFL. When one team has success, another wants to duplicate its path to good fortune. It's what I call the Texas snake problem. Texas is home to two species, the Texas coral snake and the Mexican milk snake, which look very much alike. The Texas coral snake is almost Black Mamba level dangerous. Its venom can kill. The Mexican milk snake can't hurt you. It's an imposter. It thrives only as long as it can dupe predators into thinking it's dangerous. Teams try to get away with this kind of lazy copycatting all the time. They try to succeed by hiring a coach who has all the same markings and temperaments as Belichick or Walsh, without really understanding what makes both men killers: drive, decision-making, and realistic optimism. But mimicking success rarely earns success, even in New England. Every once in a while, a Patriots coach will watch tape on the treadmill because Belichick does, or tailor his clothes with a pair of scissors. But when that's as deep as the imitation goes, the players and the rest of the staff see right through it. A guy like that is inevitably a short timer. What wouldn't Belichick do? Fake it. Chapter 10. Fearless Forecast. The Future of Football. If you don't like change, you are going to like irrelevance even less. Eric Shinseki, United States Army General, retired. One of my first memories of color television, yes, I'm old, was watching Batman on ABC every Tuesday and Wednesday night in the 1960s. The program featured Adam West in the title role and Burt Ward as Robin, his trusted companion in tights. I loved how the dynamic duo always managed to catch the arch-villains by the end of each two-episode story arc, even though I secretly wondered why the Joker or King Tut never pulled out a revolver and, you know, just shot the unarmed Cape Crusaders. I have to say that my all-time favorite scenes were the ones that took place down in the Batcave. I just loved that Batcave. All those crime-fighting gadgets seemed so far-fetched and impossible. I mean, the Bat-computer solving one of Riddler's riddles? How did it do that? Of course, if you watch that show today, and I'm not too proud to admit that I do, one of the first things you notice is that most of those crazy make-believe contraptions down in the Batcave are now part of our daily lives. Bat-computers, Bat-maps, Bat-phones, Bat-circuit streaming TV. As crazy as it sounds, the show was actually a fairly accurate peek into tomorrow. It reminds me, of course, of a lyric from a Springsteen song that says, "We're all living in the future, and none of this has happened yet." Except now it has. So, what's next? I'm often asked what the game will look like 10 years from now or 20. Some worry, and more than a few hope, that there won't even be football down the line. It's safe to say that the game I love is at a crossroads. Unfortunately, those inside that world just aren't conditioned to think that way. The 19th century philosopher Thomas Carlyle said, "Our main business is not to see what lies dimly at a distance, but to do what lies clearly at hand." That is the essence of football. Inside the game, what matters most is the next opponent, the next series, the next play. However, from my current perspective, I can see that change will be necessary to keep football alive. I'm convinced that it can actually be a good thing because the changes most needed, adjustments to safety regimens, improvements in technology, will spark an evolution in strategies and the game itself. The futuristic elements of football that we can only dream about today will come to fruition one day, and if you love this sport the way I do, that's an exciting and uplifting thought to consider. As we come to the end of this audiobook, I thought it would be fun and maybe even helpful to imagine what comes next for my favorite game. Player health is the top agenda item for owners, players, and fans alike. At least that's what they all claim. And whether they're being truthful or just mouthing platitudes, it needs to be today, tomorrow, next week, next year, and for as long as football is played. Trying to make what is a brutal game less dangerous has always been a challenge, and that isn't about to change. Modern football was actually launched in 1906 with rules that made the forward pass explicitly legal to make the game safer. The technique had been invented a few years earlier by Native American players at what were then called Indian schools, who used it to great effect when playing against larger white players. Most high school and college coaches, there was no professional game to speak of then, disliked forward passing, which they thought of as a gimmick. But in 1905, around 20 prep and college players died as a result of injuries sustained on the gridiron. In that era, most organized football was a mass momentum rushing game in which all 22 guys on the field went headfirst at one another. spurred on by President Theodore Roosevelt, a football fan who was being pressured to ban the game, college rulemakers hoped that by encouraging forward passing and later by lengthening the distance needed for a first down from 5 to 10 yards and increasing the number of downs from 3 to 4, they would open up the game, making it more exciting even as they made it less hazardous. And it worked, until it didn't. Some people blame larger and faster athletes. Others blame improved equipment that give players a false sense of invulnerability. Still others blame poor tackling techniques. I think it's a combination of all three. But whatever the root causes, no one wants to see what happened to Steelers linebacker Ryan Shazier on a Monday Night Football broadcast late in the 2017 season. Defending a short crossing route, Shazier lowered his head to make a tackle, as players do hundreds of times a game, and immediately grabbed at his back before going limp. As he was taken off the field, immobilized on a stretcher, everyone watching could only hope he would be all right. Although he continues to improve, his return to football is highly unlikely. There's no getting around the fact that horrific injuries stemming from routine plays are increasingly common on NFL fields. Can we prevent it from happening? No. I'm sorry, but that's the unvarnished truth. That said, in the last few years, there has been a concerted effort to make the game safe, or as safe as it can be, and it has begun to influence the way things are done on the field. When I was with the 49ers in the 1980s, we had Ronnie Lott, one of the greatest cornerbacks ever to grace the field. Did he lead with his head? Sometimes. Did he hit harder than just about anyone else? Always. Did he use those two parts of his game to physically intimidate opponents and take over games? Absolutely. In fact, when we faced the Los Angeles Rams and their Hall of Fame running back Eric Dickerson, we swapped our free safety, Dwight Hicks, with Lott, so that Lott could patrol the middle of the field and use his power and his sheer presence to wear down Dickerson. A few years later, Belichick, looking for his own Ronnie Lott, drafted Eric Turner, a big guy with a love for contact, at the top of the 1991 draft for the Browns. In Lott and Turner's day, receivers weren't eager to range across the middle for fear of being demolished as they laid out to make a catch. The rib-crushing reputations of Lott and Turner were like a 12th defender. That said, I'm not so sure we take Turner or Lott so high in the draft today. Recent safety-first changes make me think that guys like that, even when they tackle with proper technique, can't have the same impact. In fact, when the Jets made LSU's Jamal Adams a high pick in 2017, my initial reaction was, sure, the guy is a great player, but the rules will prevent him from dominating in the league. Nowadays, why would you spend a high draft pick or pay a lot of money to protect the middle of the field or intimidate receivers when both tactics have been legislated out of the game? Cutting across the middle is a less fraught proposition now that the defenseless receivers are protected by the prospects of unnecessary roughness penalties on overly aggressive defensive backs who also face huge fines and even suspensions. To be fair, such protections only go so far. Eagles safety Malcolm Jenkins knocked Patriots wide receiver Brandon Cooks out of Super Bowl 52 with a crushing blow that was completely legal. A lot of good those rules did Cooks. Still, a player's ability to intimidate definitely has been curtailed by those defenseless player rules and the crackdown on helmet-to-helmet collisions. Thus, using a top-10 pick on a guy whose game features intimidation feels like a bit of a waste. I still think Adams will be an excellent pro, but will he be a force, a presence? I don't believe so. And going forward, this will be an issue in front offices. Talent executives will have to understand how increased safety initiatives change certain players' value. More and more, defending the pass is about coverage, not collision. The game is a skill and space game now. No matter how hard he hits, If a defensive back cannot hit in space or make plays in the passing game, bat balls down, or intercept them, it won't matter. Unless a player can have an impact on the game on all three downs, he will lose value. I sympathize with players now being punished for playing the game in a physical style they were taught when they were young, but the rules have turned bangers into more of a liability than an asset. When I think about making the game safer, my mind wanders to the robot featured in Fox's graphics. In a perfect world, all the players in the league